yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, we had announced last week that we were going to have two guest activists at the local level in the union movement, and the discussion was going to be about the discontent at that level with the Democratic Party and what it's delivered for labor, particularly union labor. Not to be confused with the attitude of the top heads of the unions, who are always sticking their head under the skirts of the Democratic Party, trying to get whatever they can, small crumbs, etc. Okay, but problem is, one of my guests has to work today, was called in and got to pay the bills, so he's not able to be here, and we're rescheduling this till next week. Okay, so next week's show will be this discussion of what's going on in union labor and the discontent that's growing with the Democratic Party, not only with what they've the party has failed to deliver in the past, but with the view that they're not fighting Trump very, very vigorously here in the new phase here, and they're looking pretty weak and ineffective. Anyway, that's next week. That's next week. Okay, so this week what I'm going to talk about is taxes, because that's the biggie coming around the corner. You know, we just had this very interesting development with the Obamacare, ACA, the repeal of the ACA. They got repealed. You know, the repeal of the repeal, and the fiasco for the Trumps and the Republican administration here. You know, that had involved $592 billion in tax cuts for wealthy individuals, in particular, and corporations, businesses. Now they're not going to get that $592 billion. I believe that eventually they will come back and try to get some of that, at least. That's too big a piece of pie here for them to totally ignore. And there'll be another, at some strategic moment, effort to redo the ACA. It won't be a repeal. It will be a compromise. And the big compromise, of course, will be they'll keep ACA in some form, and some of the benefits of ACA, particularly Medicaid, which the states are now realizing, boy, they really need that Medicaid, which, by the way, is one of the better elements of the ACA. I've always supported the Medicaid part of that. That will remain, I predict, they'll trade that off for some portion of the $592 billion. Tax cuts on rich and businesses. But that's coming later. What's coming first in terms of taxes is the biggie, the one they've always wanted, that they've been salivating, Republicans have been salivating over here for since 2010, and that is another big whack at the tax code in order to cut business taxes and income taxes on the very wealthy households here. Boy, they've wanted that for some time, and they made a couple attempts to get it. But when it was slow growth here in the economy following the collapse of 2008-09, and they wanted all of these spending cuts, it was pretty hard to get tax cuts and spending cuts. Tax cuts for the rich while you're cutting all the spending for the rest of us. Compromised the two parties of the corporate party of America, compromised on the spending cuts. You know, they cut $1 trillion out of the social program spending budget in 2011. Well, you know, it was kind of hard for them to really play Robin Hood for the rich and take $1 trillion there and give another $1 trillion to to the wealthy. They tried that back in 2011 and 12, but they couldn't pull that one off. What they got was an $800 billion tax cut for corporations at the end of 2012, which were really just the continuation of the Bush tax cuts of the previous decade. That was called the Fiscal Cliff Agreement. It wasn't net new. It was a continuation of what they had already passed in the 2000s under George Bush. We'll talk about that shortly. I think it's worthwhile to take a step back and look at the whole history of tax cutting in the U.S. and the tax code revisions in the U.S. Since World War One. You know, World War One, or just before, is the period in which finally the U.S. passed a corporate income tax and a personal income tax. It took, pretty much a constitutional amendment to do it. But in 1913, we passed the corporate, before that, the corporate income tax. It was called something else. It wasn't called an income tax, but it was. I think that was 1912. And then the personal income tax was passed for the first time in 1913. Well, why did the big capitalists and the wealthy do that? Why did they pass taxes on themselves, on the wealthy? It partly is explainable by the fact that the U.S. was becoming a big player on the global imperialist scene. It wanted its own colonies. Europe was way ahead in terms of colonization. The U.S. Went and stole the Philippines and Cuba. It went to war with Spain to grab those early colonies. But to finance the Spanish-American War was a fiasco. They ended up with a hodgepodge of kind of property taxes and excise taxes of sorts on wealthy households, and it created a lot of discontent among the wealthy. That if you're going to play a big role on the global scene here, we can't have that kind of a tax base where the rich didn't know how much they were going to be taxed, and it varied from year to year and group to group. It just didn't work. So there was a big movement, of course, among the progressive movement to tax incomes, and the wealthy and political elites ran with that and structured it the way they wanted in order to raise more income for the federal government. I mean, if you're going to be a player, you're going to need a bigger defense, bigger defense budget. You're going to have to build a navy. And, of course, in 1912, 13, they saw a war coming in Europe. They almost had the World War in 1912. So the U.S. Elites passed the income tax. And that first income tax was very progressive, by the way. Only the very rich paid. Well, the rest of the working class couldn't pay because they didn't have anything left over. Wages were so paltry before World War One. You're talking about 10, 15 cents an hour. There was nothing left over to tax in terms of wages. And even small businesses, weren't particularly wealthy. It was only the very, very rich. So if they were going to develop their own war budgets and so forth, they would have to tax themselves and do so in a way that appeared fair among their wealthy households. And that was the personal income tax. World War One saw the development of taxes. This was the first time that we saw a corporate tax, a personal income tax. First time we saw a real inheritance tax, or what's called the estate tax, on households of deceased wealthy, and other tax forms as well. This is the birth of the modern tax system, right before World War One. And taxes on the wealthy were increased significantly as the war went on in order to pay for the U.S. involvement in the war. In other words, we raised taxes to pay for the war, World War One. It was also paid in large part also by raising bonds, the government selling bonds. But, you know, the tax part of the financing of that war was significant, and it was mostly levied on the very rich. After World War One, of course, those high levies were radically and quickly reduced during the 1920s. And it increased the amount of disposable wealth and income in the hands of the wealthy. And that big tax cut played a in stages in the early 1920s, played a significant part as well in fueling the speculative boom in investments during the 1920s, including the stock market boom. So there's a direct relationship to the income growth of the wealthy class, the 1%, and speculative investing and financial asset bubble booms and busts. And, of course, we know when eventually the big busts come, it translates into a very deep contraction, sometimes a depression, as which occurred in 1929 after. Okay, in which, in a more muted sense, we've seen here after 2008-9. Okay, so there's a relationship between the tax distribution system and the wealth of the very rich and speculative instability, financial instability that follows in turn as income inequality rises significantly as tax cuts on the top ends and corporations are reduced. Okay. In the 1930s, of course, we engaged in the New Deal. Excuse me. Social spending, the New Deal program, and taxes on the rich were raised again up to 90%, 70 to 90%. And then World War II came. World War II is when the personal income tax, corporate tax, were raised to 91%. But at that time, also, taxes were broadened, as they said. The base was broadened, and they started taxing for the first time workers. You know, everyone was working more than 40 hours a week, making a lot of money, and there were wage controls. You couldn't spend it, and there was rationing. You couldn't spend it, right? So the government took back some of those wage gains in the form of income taxes now imposed on workers. And before that, the average median worker family did not pay income taxes during the 30s and any time before that. It was only with the 1942 Revenue Act and revenue acts every year thereafter that the income tax was broadened on a larger base. In other words, lower incomes started paying income taxes. It was also in 42 that for the first time, payroll deduction of federal taxes began. It was only supposed to be, under the law, it was written, till the duration of the war. When the war was after, payroll deduction of taxes was supposed to end. Ah, but we know it didn't end, right? It continued. Still to this day, we have payroll deduction for wage earners. You know, we don't have deductions off of income statements for businesses or the income they pay quarterly. The government gets your money if you're a wage earner, and if you're smart enough, you might be able to get a little bit of it back. It gets it up front, right, with payroll deduction of taxes, but businesses get to fudge what they pay and figure out before and give the government less than it's due, and then the government has to come after them to get the rest. You see, it's just the opposite for wage earners. The government takes more, and you got to come after them to get some back. With businesses, it's just the opposite. They give the government less, and the government has to audit and go after them to get what it was supposed to get. So that's an interesting difference in relationships, isn't it, between wage earners and businesses under the current tax system. Okay, so in 1953, we had another big tax reform act to start reducing the taxes on the wealthy that had occurred during World War II to help pay for the war. Once again, World War II, significant tax increases to pay for war, just as in World War I. Yes, there was also a lot of floating of government bonds to help pay for it, but the wage, the tax part of financing World War II was significant, as well as it was significant during World War I. Except in World War II, now it's broadened. It's, you know, they're paying, workers are paying part of the bill now for the first time. And again, as in 1920s, we see the government with a major tax act starting to reduce the tax load on wealthy households and businesses. That's the background a little bit here. it's interesting to contrast what's happened with taxes here. I'm jumping ahead a little bit since 2001 in the perpetual wars in the Middle East, because this is the first time in U.S. history we've never raised taxes to pay for wars. All the other occasions, even during Vietnam War, taxes were raised to pay in part the cost of war. Now taxes have been cut massively during a period in which the cost of war rise equally massively. Wow, how did they pull that off? Cutting taxes and increasing war spending? Doesn't that devastate the budget, U.S. budget, and raise the debt? You bet. Well, they just let it go. They just allow these budget deficits and debt increase for the first time in our history here in the last 15 years. Okay. Not such good capitalist budget management, I would say, on the state level. Anyway, we'll come back to that. Let's continue with our review here of the tax situation. Why are we going through all this trouble, the background of tax situation? Because we got this big, massive new tax cut bill coming. The Republicans and Trump are going to pull off, you know, another 1953 massive tax cut for the rich, and a massive Reagan 1981 tax cut for the rich, and a massive George Bush Jr. 2001-3 tax cuts for the rich and their corporations. Now we got another big wave of tax cutting coming under Trump and the Republicans. Periodically, in other words, corporations and the corporate elite engage in these massive tax cutting to make sure that they don't pay the bill, or the bill that they've been paying doesn't continue to rise, that they reduce it. Well, this is repeating. This is a repeat in U.S. economic history. You know, before World War I, during World War II, and after, here 53, and we'll see now under Reagan and under Bush, these waves of massive tax cuts on corporations and the wealthy elite. We're talking about the 1% to 5% of wealthiest households who make virtually all of their income, all their wealth is from investments. You know, they don't, quote, work for a living for somebody else. They take from everybody else who is working for a living. Okay, continuing here our survey. Under Kennedy, JFK here, in 1961-62, we had a significant cut in corporate business taxes. What was that? Well, the top rate was reduced to 70%, right, and cut. And we had the introduction of what was called an investment tax credit. In other words, this was designed to stimulate business to reinvest in plant and equipment that would create jobs in the U.S. That was a $3.5 billion at the time, pretty large, investment tax credit, the new feature of the tax code. Under Kennedy, you didn't get the $3.5 billion, or your share of it if you were a corporation, until you actually did make the investment and proved that you had actually hired people. $3.5 billion investment tax credit. So it was, you know, aimed at the U.S. economy, and you had to prove that you did it before you got it. Well, we're going to see that this investment tax credit got expanded and liberalized first under Nixon and then under Reagan significantly to where it is today, a tax credit for businesses to expand, to reinvest. But one, they don't have to prove they actually did it after the fact. And two, they can invest offshore and get the tax credit. Two big changes, you see. We'll come back to that. Okay, so Kennedy introduces the investment tax credit, $3.5 billion, lowers the top rate. What about Nixon? Nixon comes along in 1971 and introduces his new economic program, which froze wages and then controlled them and went after U.S. corporations' foreign competitors. There's a number of features here. Took the U.S. all out of the Bretton Woods international monetary system and collapsed it, which ended up in the devaluation of the dollar and U.S. exports increasing at the expense of Europe and Japan. And a general tax package was passed along with that. Tariff hikes, reduction of excise taxes on autos, introduction of a border tax, in other words, on imports, of 10%. Sound familiar? Yes. Well, you know, Trump is talking about 20% border tax, you know, and big brouhaha over that. Well, Nixon had passed the 10% import tax. There wasn't so much disagreement at that time. And, you know, the border tax we'll get in the new bill here that will come out, it will probably be 10% too. You know, it won't be 20%. It'll be 10%, I predict. Okay. So the package of tax cuts that Nixon passed in 1971 was about $8 for corporations and the rich and $1 for the rest. You know, they always give a little bit of a consumer tax cut sweetener in these big corporate wealthy investor tax cut bills to buy some votes. So the ratio was 8-1. You know, $8 for them, $1 for us. And that was the Nixon tax package. And the big thing about the Nixon tax package was this 10% border tax and the fact that the investment tax credit, you no longer had to prove that you did it. You just claim it and you get it. Okay? That was a big change in 1971. And then, of course, we get... the Reagan tax cuts. Reagan comes into office in 1981 and immediately proposes a $752 billion tax cut for 1981-82. $752 billion. Now, you know, Obama proposes a $787 billion stimulus package of tax cuts, $300 billion, and the rest spending in 2009. On a GDP of about, I don't know, $10 trillion, $8 to $10 trillion was our GDP. Well, a little more than that, maybe. So $787 billion, you know, roughly one-tenth, one-twelfth, you know, of the $10 trillion GDP. Well, Reagan's $752 billion package was on a GDP of $4 trillion. So massive, massive. It was really, you know, four times larger than Obama's stimulus. Okay, so Reagan was far more aggressive on the tax side than Obama was, and major tax cuts here, which were supposed to stimulate the economy because part of Reagan's other program was to raise interest rates to 20%. Yes, 20%, raising interest rates. Which threw us deeply into a deep recession, 1981-82. You know, it shut down the auto and housing industries pretty much. Okay. Well, the big tax cuts were supposed to offset the big contraction effects of fiscal spending cuts on social spending and high interest rates. However, you know, there was no cuts in defense spending. We were expanding defense spending. The whole Reagan mix was increase war spending, defense spending by hundreds of billions of dollars, and cut social programs by hundreds of billions, they were supposed to offset each other. Well, they didn't. The war spending defense spending was a hell of a lot more than the social cuts, and you got a big budget deficit. Well, reducing the taxes was supposed to also stimulate recovery. This was the supply side nonsense they talked about, the Laffer tax cuts, that if you cut taxes, people were going to work more and businesses were going to invest more and therefore you'd get more tax revenue in the end. Well, it didn't work out that way, empirically, historically. But we get these massive tax cuts, $752 billion, which were really a cut, big cuts in the top rates, you see. Top rates for personal income taxes and top rates for corporate income taxes. The top rate was reduced from 70% to 50%. And small businesses, their top rate was reduced from 25% to 15%. Another way that the 1981 tax cuts redistributed the income to the rich and their corporations was through this this thing called depreciation write-offs, depreciation of equipment, which is kind of another way of saying a business tax cut, right? If I'm a business, if I can depreciate my existing equipment and structures faster, right, I can deduct the cost of that depreciation off of my business tax bill to the government. So it's really a tax cut. What happened in 1981 was this depreciation was accelerated. What does that mean? That means instead of writing off a business van or something in 5 years, now I could write it off in 3 years. Instead of writing off, office equipment, over the life of that equipment that should have been 5 years, I can now write it off in 1 year. It's a de facto tax business tax cut when we say accelerated depreciation. Right? What also happened was the capital gains income tax cuts here was reduced from a 49% rate to a 20% rate, and the first 60% of any capital gains was deducted. In other words, you didn't pay anything on your first 60% of capital gains, and then you pay 20% instead of 49% on the rest. Okay. Estate and gift taxes were reduced. Gifts to spouses were no longer taxed. You just give a lot of money to your wife here instead of put it in, an independent savings account, and you didn't pay taxes on them. Inheritance taxes, estate taxes, in other words, were reduced, so only 0.3% of the population paid any inheritance tax. This is all part of 1981 taxes, right? And then the rate on which you did pay was reduced to 50%. IRAs were created for the wealthier households, those with the median, well, not median, but 60 to 90% income share households, they got IRAs. There was adjustments for a bracket creep, as they called it. That is, you moved into a higher bracket as you made more income. So just by making more income, your taxes would increase. Well, they adjusted that by adjusting the brackets. So a lot of measures here in the 1981 tax cut that effectively reduced taxes on the very wealthy and their corporations. When Reagan came into office, before him was Carter, and the tax revolution really begins under Carter in 1978, but it really isn't passed. The proposals prior, they were bouncing around in business prior to 1980, actually get implemented under under Reagan. Right? Just to give you an idea of the shift in the tax burden for median family, In the 1950s, a median family, and that was median income, working class family, paid about 5% of its income, disposable income, in income taxes, and about 2% of its disposable income in the payroll tax. So the total tax burden, you know, short of state and local government taxes, I'm not including here, was about 7% of your income. How many of you pay in only 7% of your income in income taxes? Think about it, right? Well, that's the way it was in the 1950s. But by 1980, this is when Reagan comes into office and hasn't yet passed his 81 tax bonus for the rich, that had already risen to 24% from 7%. Total tax burden for median family in 1950s, by 1980, it was 24%. Well, how many of you still are paying only 24% in income tax and payroll tax and all the other taxes? Go get your check stub and check it out. You know, might be interesting to see how much you're paying, you know, FICA and all the rest, right? Well, you're paying at least 6.2% and 1.45% each of you, if there's two in the family, in payroll taxes. So it's about 8% payroll taxes each, right? So that's 16%. That's just payroll taxes. And then, of course, you have your income taxes on top of that. And you're probably at least in the 10 to 20% tax bracket. So you're probably paying well over 30%. Of your income here in taxes today. Well, in 1980, it was 24%. Before that, it was only 7%. After the Reagan tax cuts, the median family was now paying 28% in income and payroll taxes of their income. 28% of their income was going to payroll and income taxes. I'm sure, you're well over 28%. And if you add 9% in 1985 for state and local government taxes, you got a total tax load in 1985, 30 years ago, of 37%. 37% 1985. That includes state and local taxes of various kinds, you know, sales taxes, property taxes, fees of all kinds, etc., right? 37% 1980. Well, we're probably playing close to 50% now when you add it all up. But keep in mind that this is median family. We're talking about total tax burden. At the same time, at the very top, the tax burden is being cut. Multi-millionaires, billionaires do not pay 40, 50% in taxes. They pay a hell of a lot less. You know, you add it all up. And they pay maybe 10% if they pay at all. All this talk going on now, trying to justify this new Republican Trump tax bill, argues that the tax burden is too high, especially on U.S. corporations. You know, they've got to pay U.S. taxes, and they have 35% for corporate taxes, top tax rate, 35%. And then they got to pay all these foreign taxes to governments that these multinational corporations may be doing business in, right? And then they got state and local government here in the U.S. taxes, so that poor U.S. corporations are paying well over 50%, multinational corporations. Well, that's just a discussion that focuses on formal rates, tax rates for corporations. It is not the effective tax, meaning what they actually pay. Studies have been shown that the actual effective tax rate for corporations in the U.S. is somewhere around 12%. That's it. For all taxes, maybe another 2% that they have to pay for offshore taxes to offshore governments, 2%, and then maybe 2% on average for state and local government taxes. So they're paying about 16-17% max. So a long way from saying, oh, 50% total. We have the highest corporate tax rates in the world. It's nominal. Nominal tax rates. It's not the actual tax burden, actual what they write a check for. And some of these corporations don't write a check for anything. They get money back from the government, and I'll explain how they do that. Okay. In loopholes were added in 1981 Reagan tax bill. In other words, oil and railroad companies now were eligible for the investment tax credit. They had their own special depletion taxes, oil depletion taxes, but now they could also, build new plants and refineries and get a, which are very expensive, and get a 10% tax investment tax credit for that, right? Or they could build it, offshore somewhere in another country, Angola or Venezuela or something, and they would get the same 10% off their U.S. taxes, you see. Also, another big loophole was introduced in 81. If you couldn't use your 10% investment tax credit, or you had decided as a company you weren't going to use it that year, what you could do is trade it. You could sell it to another company. This was called safe harbor leasing. Nice big loophole, safe harbor leasing, right? I sell my 10% to another company. That other company now has my 10%, and it has its own 10%. It has a 20% tax credit that it can claim on any kind of expansion of its operations, its facilities, whether it's in the U.S. or anywhere else. In 1981, General Electric played that game and got a check back from the U.S. government for $110 million. You see, the tax credit, a credit, is far more lucrative than a deduction. A deduction is before you figure out what your taxes have to be. A credit is, okay, this is your taxes, now you cut that bottom line by the amount of the credit. Safe harbor leasing was a big boondoggle under the Reagan bill, and corporations took big advantage of it. So was the faster depreciation. That was a big tax cut, corporate business tax cut. And, of course, reducing the top rate from 70 to 50%, and the capital gains rate from 49 to 20%, and exempting the first 60% of that, reducing the state and gift taxes, cutting taxes here on the 5% wealthiest households. The reduction was $600 billion, an income tax reduction. Income tax, not the corporate tax, which is depreciation and the top rate and so forth. So, the top rate corporation elements, about another $150 billion, but the big gains were the capital gains and dividend cuts, $600 billion. Most of it concentrated on the wealthiest 10% and above, right? The median family, which at the time was making $25,000 a year in income, got somewhere between $26 and $84 a year in tax cuts. So if you were, a median worker family making $25,000 at the time, you got $26 maybe of that $600 billion in tax cuts. Yeah, okay, there's a lot more workers, but $26, average $50 a year, that's nothing. That's chump change, you see. Even when you add up all the 90 million workers at the time, households, right? So it was virtually, just a little taste for the average worker in the Reagan tax bill cut, and $600 billion in taxes for wealthier households. That was in 1981. Tax Act, okay? And as a result, by 85, as I said, tax cuts, the share of tax burden went down dramatically for corporations and the rich, and the share went up correspondingly for average working families and households. We had another big tax cut in Tax Act called the 1986 tax reform. They had cut taxes on corporations and wealthy so much that it was ballooning the budget here. You know, tax revenue has collapsed as a result of the 81 Tax Act. And they said, well, we got to take some of it back. You know, it's just too much here. So they had what they call the tax reform. Well, what kind of reform was it? I'll tell you. The tax top rate, the personal income tax, was reduced further. You know, in 81, I mean, it was reduced from 70 to 50%. Well, now in 86, the top rate was reduced from 50 to 28%. And the top corporate income tax rate was reduced from 46 to 34%. Okay, so they're still cutting the rates, right? At the same time, 650 special provisions, as they call them, we'll call them loopholes, were introduced. You see, there's two ways to cut the money on the tax burden on the rich. You reduce the top rate. That's one way. Or you raise the top rate, make it look like you're tightening taxes, but you introduce massive loopholes. Well, in 86, they did both. You see, they reduced the top tax rates for corporate and income tax, personal, and they introduced 650 special provisions. A lot of the loopholes that we see today, you know, like corporate inversions that they call it, and other loopholes that I've talked about before, for multinational corporations in particular, originate from the 86 tax reform. 650 special provisions, right? Now, what also happened in 86 as part of this act was the modern payroll tax revisions. Well, what were those? Well, remember, in 1950s, only 2% of your income was payroll taxes, right? Well, in 1986, they totally revised the payroll tax system, and they indexed the amount that you would have to pay taxes on and raise the tax rate. Index means as your income went up, right, the base on which the tax rate was calculated also went up, right? It was kind of a cost of living for government revenue here, right? So they raised that by indexing it, and every year it's been increasing ever since. In 1981, the maximum amount of the base for the payroll tax was $1,502. Today, it's $118,000 plus, I think. I haven't looked at the latest here. Okay, so in other words, you will pay your tax, your payroll tax rate, you pay you, the worker pays, you know, 6.2%, and the company pays 6.2%. So it's 12.4% on a base of $118,000. Now, if you are a high-paid executive, well, you don't even have to be high-paid, just a middle manager, right? You're going to hit $118,000 before the end of the year, which means come June or July, you're going to get a 6.2% pay hike because you're no longer going to be paying the payroll tax, you see. But only if you're making six figures, you see. You got to be making six figures, you know, almost 130, 40, 50,000 now, at least. And a lot of people are up there, you know, well-paid professionals, middle managers, right, software engineers, and so forth. But the very, very wealthy who get these CEOs and top managers and so forth, you know, they may max out by March or April, paying their income tax, I mean their payroll tax, right? And after that, they get a hike. Because we have this cap, you see, the cap after $118,000, anybody making more than that doesn't have to pay the payroll tax anymore. Well, why the hell do we have that? It was never designed that way. Congress just let it happen as they did not adjust for bracket creep for the payroll tax, in other words, but they adjusted for bracket creep for the rich on the personal income tax. Workers didn't get a bracket creep adjustment on payroll tax, but the wealthy did on income tax. So every year you pay more and more for the payroll tax because every year that base rises from 18,000, and you know, next year it'll be 120 something, and 10 years from now it'll be 140, 50,000, right? That will be the base, and the rate has stayed the same. Although in 1986 the rate was increased as well, so we got this indexing and a rate increase in 1986, and Social Security produced a surplus over the next 20 years of $1.6 trillion. Right? Higher earners were exempt. Higher wage earners, salary earners, CEOs, and so forth, and their salary were exempt. But capital incomes were totally exempt, as they always have been from the Social Security payroll tax. Whatever you make on capital gains and dividends and so forth, you pay no taxes on that income. That's what we call unearned income. Wage income is earned income. And that's what the payroll tax is calculated on. But even that calculation, right, exempts those at the top of the earned income spectrum and totally has always exempted those making capital incomes. Notwithstanding all that, we still generated, since 1986, a $1.6 trillion in Social Security surplus. Well, why are you talking about Social Security's in trouble? Well, it's not. You know, that's it. All of that surplus, by the way, has been diverted. It goes into the Social Security Trust Fund, and then the government borrows from that trust fund, takes that money out every year, the real money that people pay in their payroll taxes, puts in a treasury bond, in other words, trades it for a treasury bond. It borrows all that cash, all that money. And that huge $1.6 trillion has enabled the U.S., in the 21st century, to wage these wars without raising taxes, because it borrows it from itself, from the Social Security Trust Fund. The U.S. also borrows from everyone else in the world with treasury bonds, right? And enables the U.S. for the first time in its history to pay $3, $4 trillion in wars. It never raises taxes. At the same time, it cuts taxes on corporations and the rich at the same time. You see, the Social Security surplus hasn't totally offset this cutting in taxes that we'll talk about under Bush and the wars, right? Hasn't totally offset that. And the U.S. has to borrow even more from China, Japan, and everywhere else, but plays a big role, significantly offsets it. The surplus, Social Security surplus, which is a kind of transfer from workers to the rich, isn't it? You know, If you take the surplus and you reduce corporate taxes and high-end personal income taxes, you're just moving the money around from workers' payrolls to wealthy dividend and investment tax cuts. Okay. That was the 1986 tax reform, which was partly payroll tax increases to offset cuts on the wealthy top rates in corporations, right? All right. Median family in 1986 got a tax cut of $467 a year. Median family making about $35,000 a year got a tax cut of $467. Millionaires in 1986 got a tax cut of $281,000. All right, big difference, right? Okay, and then we move on to Clinton, and Clinton exempted more small business estates from the estate tax. He passed some education credits, but also cut corporate investor tax cuts. Not as much as George Bush would, but George Bush took the form of the Clinton tax cuts, and he just blew them wide open. In other words, the elements of the Clinton tax cuts were nominal, right? You know, there were some education credits, for households, and marriage penalty credits, and child care credits, and so forth, right? These were all introduced under Clinton. So the shift, the tax shift from the workers to the rich under Clinton was the most minimal, although it did happen, of all these tax cuts that we're seeing since Reagan. Okay, so George Bush comes into office, and passes $3.4 trillion in tax cuts, 80% of which go to the wealthiest households over the ensuing decade. Okay, $3.4 trillion. Remember, Reagan, $752 billion, and then additional in 86. I don't have the numbers for that. Maybe a trillion. But now we got Bush tax cuts are really Reagan on steroids here. $3.4 trillion. At the same time, of course, we're spending $3.4 trillion on wars in the Middle East. We start spending, right? Anyway, we're cutting taxes by $3.4 trillion. Well, you know, you cut taxes by $3 trillion, you raise defense spending, wars by $3 trillion. You know, you got a $6 trillion deficit, don't you? And that's just about what happened. You know, the federal debt went from $4 trillion to about $9 trillion under Bush. A lot of that can be attributed to the shift, right? Wars, $3-4 trillion, tax cuts, mostly for the rich, $3.4 trillion. Okay. Bush, in his first, there were a series of three tax cuts here in 2001, right? He cuts, estate tax, the inheritance tax rate to 45% from 55, and he exempts the first 7 million. Of the estate. The income tax cuts amounted to $1.01 trillion. $1.10 trillion. Households that made over $147,000 a year got 71% of that trillion-plus cut. And the top 1% households that were earning at the time just under $400,000 a year in income got 47%, half of the 1.35 total trillion tax cut in 2001. 126 million households at the time were earning less than $76,000 a year. They got 29%. But remember, their payroll taxes are rising and their state and local government taxes are rising, right? So 6 million of 132 million households got the lion's share of this, you know, or three-fourths of this trillion-dollar tax cut, right? All right, so that was the first Bush tax cut. The second Bush tax cut comes in 2002. Instead of focusing on income taxes, it focuses on corporate taxes. The depreciation was accelerated, corporate business depreciation, by 30%. A new thing was introduced called Section 179, expenses write-offs. Businesses could write off the first $59,000 of their expenses as a tax cut. That's in addition to depreciation, right? Depreciation on buildings, commercial buildings, instead of writing it off over 39 years, you could write it off over 5 years. There was this thing called net operating loss rules, which meant that if you paid taxes as a business 3 years ago, right, and now today your taxes, you lost money, you could go back and refile 3 years ago and get a check back from the taxes you paid 3 years ago based on the losses you have today, right? Nice. Net operating loss. Wouldn't it be nice if we could do that? Well, that was the 2002 tax cuts, right? Depreciation and net operating loss in Section 179, on top of the personal income tax cuts of the year earlier. But we're not through. In 2003, the third Bush tax cut focuses on dividends and capital gains. And the dividends and capital gains, dividends were cut from 39.5% back to 15%. Capital gains from 20% to 15%. Okay, so we're paying in 2003 capital gains, in other words, stock appreciation, bond appreciation, that kind of stuff, speculative capital gains, right? 15%. Just about half of what it was in 1990, which was 28%. Also, the estate tax was, inheritance tax was cut as well. And all this was made retroactive to 2001. Nice. Big tax cut, you know? Big. You know, I said $3.4 trillion total for all these tax cuts during Bush's first term. You know, $1 trillion in 2001. And the rest, $2.4 trillion, really, in 2002, 2003. Corporate the corporate share, corporate income tax share in the U.S., government revenues, federal revenues, declines from about 20% in the 50s and 60s to, was it 7% today? Maybe less? I don't know. Okay. In 2003, also the Section 179 allowing, you know, write-off of expenses was increased from $25,000 to $100,000. If you're a small business, you know, anything you spend on any equipment, supplies, and everything, you just deduct it from your taxes up to $100,000. Nice deal. They don't pay any taxes, right? Okay. Child care, you know, marriage penalties, education, these were little sweeteners that were introduced to get it sold. Ah, but you know what? They were only for 2 years.